our chat, but more on topic.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Politico magazine recently asked a panel of historians to look back and look ahead on the occasion of the United States' 250th birthday. They asked such questions as, how has America's role in the world changed, and what is its role today? What does America need to last another 250 years? And what letter grade would you give the current state of American democracy? So today on the program, we'll talk with one of those panelists. Greg Jackson is author of Been There, Done That, How Our History Shows What We Can Overcome. That's out just, I think, last month and out and available for you. He's host of the podcast History That Doesn't Suck. And he's America 250 professor in constitutional studies at Utah Valley University. Greg Jackson, thanks so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
There are a few of the things I didn't mention. You have a stage presentation we could talk about as well. But I'd like to just jump right in here. We're, you know, it's a turbulent times, you could say that.
Sure.
But as you say in your book, not unusual. This is not unprecedented, right? We've been there and done that. We'll get into talking about that. I want to start with the Politico article. So the headline here, has Trump changed democracy forever? We asked 11 historians. So America 250, but also in these, in some ways, unprecedented times, or maybe you can correct me on that, Professor Jackson. But
we'll
I just want to
discuss it. Sure.
Well, let me just start there. Unprecedented or no?
No. And here's my book in a nutshell. This is a question that I was hit with as I've been on the road presenting and meeting podcast fans across the country. I've been to over 30 states now doing that. And whenever we got to the Q&A part in the last few years, it was, is our nation falling apart? Are we going to hang in there? And that was very much a driver in pushing me to this book that I researched and wrote over the course of a three-year span, very carefully giving attention to this idea. Now, there's the obvious answer. Of course, we're not in a civil war. But I think that's low-hanging fruit and not really even worth comparing the loss of 2% of the entire population. So we'd have to have a civil war that killed 7 million Americans, right, for that to be on par. So to me, it made no sense to even make that comparison. But what about the rest of it, right? It's still a pretty low bar if you're going to say, well, it's not as bad as the Civil War. That's hardly comforting. And what I did is I dug into broad themes. You know, you can't write a book that examines a hot topic of the day. That flips and changes in a matter of weeks. But I looked at fake news. I looked at contested elections. And I looked at political violence. Those three themes. And I present a history of the United States from the founding up to the year 1900. I chose to stop there because I wanted to demonstrate these are old problems. I didn't want 20th century issues to start appearing like, it's still fairly new. And I found stories of all three of those categories just in absolute abundance. And so I tell stories in this book of fake news, that is intentional misinformation as it's defined by academics, the New York Times, and so forth. I'm using that more constrained definition of fake news, not just news we don't like. So fake news, contested elections, political violence, and those are not new.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit here. Fake news in the book, you talk about our founding fathers. We revere these men.
We do.
But the fights in the press in the 1790s, right? Early 19th century. Thomas Jefferson, right in the middle of this, one of those revered founding fathers.
Yeah.
Hiring hacks, I think, essentially to smear the other side, right? That's what happened, I think.
So, look, there are so many things that we need to hold in our head at the same time. So one of the things I always encourage my students to do, I encourage everyone listening to my podcast to do, and now my readers, is holding what feels like contradictory concepts. One of the framings that I put forth in the start of this book, there are two sides of a barn. Light behaves like a wave and a particle. We can revere founding fathers for their ideas. I think that's very fair and right. And we can acknowledge their failings as humans, as partisans. You know, it's easier to espouse the greatest ideals during the revolution, but then you've got to govern. And that's where things start to get messy and our human shortcomings come to the fore. And in the Washington administration, as Alexander Hamilton served as Secretary of the Treasury, he put forth, as he was asked by Congress, a few different plans. And what that led to was a plan to absorb state debts from the revolution by the federal government. Thomas Jefferson didn't love that. James Madison didn't love that. They felt that was the federal government taking too much power, even as it's taking on that debt. And it was unfair to the states that carried their debt through the war. Hamilton and the Federalists answered, but some states took greater debt because the fighting was there. Massachusetts got hammered by the British, and other states were spared having to actually endure the fight. So assumption happened, but then Hamilton suggested creating a national bank, and that screamed monarchy in the eyes of Jefferson and his followers. So that's what led to the ultimate split, and trust was destroyed. Both sides are convinced that the other is trying to destroy the nation, despite the fact that these are founding fathers who helped create the nation. And a moment that I'll highlight for you, Tom, it's when I read this letter, it just struck me how human these guys are and how sadly normal this is. While Hamilton's writing a series of letters under a pseudonym in which he's defending a position that George Washington has taken, one that that is not liked by Thomas Jefferson, who's also in Washington's cabinet, by the way. So let's add that wrinkle to it. Thomas Jefferson writes a letter to James Madison, and I'm mostly quoting, slight paraphrase. My dear sir, select some of his most damning heresies, pick up your pen and cut him to pieces in the face of the public. That is, again, the author, the primary author of the Declaration of Independence, writing to the primary creator, the father, as we call him, of the Constitution, describing actions he wants, you know, a political hit to be taken out on the former Continental officer and first Secretary of the Treasury and primary author of the Federalist Papers.
Yeah, that's it got pretty vicious, right?
Yeah.
You say in the book, we have always had the will as a people to push back on these demons, right? To prevail, yes. To overcome. So I want to maybe address that a little bit, you know, because you say, well, there's a parallel in our early history to maybe today's fake news and personal attacks. But that alone doesn't give me a whole lot of hope, right? That
sure.
Tell me about that impulse to overcome that.
Sure. So look, here we are celebrating America 250. And what I encountered, you know, again, just page after page in this book, what I'm putting forth. Yeah, I just gave you one story. That's just one little sample. Other tales that I get into include during the War of 1812, where members of the Jeffersonian Republican Party literally torture. We're talking Saw movie level, no hyperbole here. I'm torture Federalists and gruesomely kill one Revolutionary War veteran, an officer. Poke them with knives, drip hot candle wax on their eyeballs while they're held open, try to dismember, tar feather, then light the feathers on fire. Those sorts of actions are taken. I described Charles Sumner being beaten, a senator, right? Nearly beaten to death as a congressman, Preston Brooks, slams him over and over again until his cane snaps, it breaks, it shatters. And with this splintered stick, he continues to hit Charles Sumner. And when other senators rush forward to try and intercede, there's Representative Kitts, also from South Carolina, holding his cane up, threatening other members of Congress. And I quote, "You let him alone, goddamn you." Right? To ensure this violence is carried out. Tom, here's the really interesting thing. We always talk, you know, people might be familiar with the caning of Charles Sumner. What we forget about is that Preston Brooks was reelected with a 30% increase in support. So America wanted that violence. Mm. Right? That's the sort of place we were at. You know, contested elections as well. We can go into all these spaces if you'd like. But what I'm trying to drive at is that these happen again and again and again. We have 250 years that we've made it. Moments, if I can use a Lincoln phrase, you know, our better angels have come to the fore. That story I was just hinting at in Baltimore, 1812, where these Jeffersonian Republicans attempted to massacre Federalists and did manage to kill one. You know, in the heat of that, an absolutely outnumbered militia captain. He had a force of 30, and he's trying to hold back a mob that some of the depositions, because there were depositions that follow a night like this, some of the depositions put the mob at over 1,000 participants. And I don't even know if you still call it a mob when they pull out a cannon. You know, you think about mobs or riots today, you know, in the way that we've seen these sorts of instances play out in the news over the last whatever decade. I've never seen a group referred to as a mob that managed to get their hands on literal artillery and pull it out to try and fire on, you know, on a target. And that's what happened that night. And this militia captain, William Barney, excuse me, Major, Major William Barney, he puts himself in front of this cannon. He himself is a Republican. This mob is made up of Republicans. He puts his chest against this cannon, refusing to let them fire unless they're willing to kill him. They light the match. They're moving it to the cannon. He's ready to die, even though it's not going to stop. That cannonball is going to rip through his chest and continue on and kill those Federals. He will die before he will fail to stand and do his duty. And William Barney's the absolute hero. So many Federalists. Now, he's the hero in a sad tale. I'm not telling you a story where everyone shakes hands at the end and decides, you know, that we are all Americans, we can get along. No, this is a story that ends in gruesome torture and some death. But those deaths would have been tenfold, would be my guess, without William Barney. Those sorts of figures who, you know, we know Lincoln, right? We know the really big names. But these smaller instances that we've forgotten about that I remind the reader of in this book, those figures are there. And they are the ones that, you know, keep us, I'm not going to say on the straight and narrow, but manage to keep us together long enough for our institutions to hold. And our institutions are stronger than we sometimes give them credit for. And that combination between institutions that were built, I mean, think about James Madison, Federalist number 51. He says, you know, that if all men were angels, right, well, we wouldn't need government. Right? And if I could just translate that to 21st century talk for your listeners, basically we have a founding father saying people suck. We understand that. And that's how we're framing this republic. The recognition that there are bad actors, right? So our institutions are designed literally with the understanding that there are bad actors who will manipulate, who will use power, who will lean into our divisions. At the same time, the founders talked about the need for public virtue. And so what I'm seeing is enough Americans with that public virtue component, those better angels that Lincoln refers to. We have enough critical mass over 250 years that they have come into play before those institutions, which are stronger than we often think, give out. If we've done that for 250 years, and I realize the Constitution is younger than that, right? We're going with 1776, not 1787 here. To me, it's data, right? We have a proven track record of overcoming our worst selves for over 200 years. Now, that's not a guarantee. I want to be clear on that. I'm not giving a Pollyanna, oh, everything's going to be fine, guys. No, this is a call to action. This is a reminder that our institutions do work, that voting works, that Americans who didn't even have the right to vote managed to get their thoughts into the public sphere and moved us toward becoming a more perfect union. My biggest fear today, Tom, is cynicism. That is the one thing that can kill us.
Yeah. Yeah, that, I see where you're going with that. And you talk about public institutions being stronger than we sometimes think. But you look at polls, the view of many of our institutions is very, you could call it cynical, is very, very negative. That's got to have a corrosive effect, right? If we're not supporting our institutions, at least in thought.
Yes. So that phrase I used a moment earlier, right? Public virtue. This is a phrase that the founders used left, right, and center, and they were very concerned about there being enough of it to keep the republic alive. I think public virtue doesn't go out of style. To me, the idea of public virtue, which is that we are thinking about the common good, and that we are civically engaged, that we are staying informed, that we are ourselves seeking to learn. Look, you can't have government by the people, right? We love throwing around that phrase, government, you know, by the people, for the people, great. Okay, what does that really mean, though? Well, if it's by the people, that means we're all engaged in this thing. Well, that means we've also got to understand the mechanisms. We've got to be participating. That is what the founders feared would kill the republic, is a lack of public virtue. It was a lack of engagement. That is, to me, the great threat. And I am just echoing them. I kind of feel like the doctor who's I'm seeing Uncle Sam, right? Well, I'm a doctor of history, but we'll say I'm a doctor of medicine for a moment, right? In this analogy, sitting there with Uncle Sam saying, "Oh, I think I'm dying," and what I'm saying is, no, you're not necessarily dying. You don't have cancer, but yes, you've got to eat right and exercise, or your heart is going to give out. Right, and that is a very different thing from simply saying, "Hey, you've made it this far, so you're going to be okay." I do want to be very clear on that. This is a message of hope, and I do mean it sincerely. I have never been more hopeful in my adult years for the American Republic than I have been after doing the research and writing this book. I'm truly filled with hope, but it's a conditional hope. It is dependent upon the American people.
Let me quote you here from this political article that I referenced. Sure. They asked, what was the question here? What does America need to last another 250 years? And you talk about public virtue that you've been talking about. And then you say, public virtue isn't simply voting once a year in November. Public virtue means making lifelong learning a habit. It requires critically assessing the media we consume. To put that in modern words, not to rely on doom scrolling for our information like that. It means participating in the political process year round, be that voting in primaries or caucuses or volunteering. So it's more of an investment than, I guess, reading the news in your silo and voting once a year.
Yes, and that is what I really do want Americans to think about. In writing this book, which of course informed much of my thoughts as Politico reached out to me, you know, I've long been familiar with Federalist Number 10, written by James Madison. It's one of the most famous of the Federalist Papers, but I found myself meditating on this particular Federalist paper, and it became a through line through the whole book. A point that he makes in Federalist Number 10 is that liberty is to faction, I'm quoting him, liberty is to faction what air is to fire, an ailment without which it expires. And he goes on, you know, to say, yeah, if you have liberty, you know, you're going to have faction, which this is just founder parlance for partisanship. So if you have liberty, you have partisanship. So here's a weird thought. Now, it doesn't excuse our worst behaviors today. I want to be very clear on that. But basically, if you have liberty, which is a term we love here in the United States, I love, and I want us to preserve, then you're going to have partisanship. So the idea that we are all going to hold hands and sing Kumbaya, that's just not happening. In fact, it's actually a symptom, you know, but I'm going to say in a positive way, that liberty exists if we have some degree of partisanship. Now, that said, if, you know, liberty is to faction what air is to fire, And James Madison makes this analogy. He goes further with it, and I'll take him even further than he goes. But he says it would be stupid. I'm paraphrasing a little bit here, of course. But he says it would be stupid to get rid of oxygen in order to get rid of fire, right? Because you will kill all animal life, as he puts it, right? We will kill ourselves trying to get rid of fire so we don't have to deal with fire. That's stupidity. Similarly, well, you can kill liberty. That will get rid of your partisanship. That's not the answer, though. No, you're talking about autocracy now, right? Authoritarianism. So we embrace that it's there, but James Madison also encourages us to, and I'm quoting him again, control its effects. So here's where I would extend his analogy. Fire's going to be there, but do we want a raging inferno like what's happening to our Canadian neighbors right now? I was breathing in smoke in Pennsylvania just a few weeks ago as I was on book tour. Smoke wafting down, you know, from north of the 49th parallel. That's damaging, right? That's think about the fires in Los Angeles in recent years. Fire is terrifying. Partisanship is terrifying. Also, fire can be the way we cook a meal. It can be illuminating at night, right? It's about harnessing that, controlling it. That's what James Madison is urging us to do. And that is what I'm echoing, is that Americans need to, again, control it. And throughout my book, it's example after example of Americans failing to harness that partisanship, learning hard lessons, and then choosing anew to harness, to pull it back in.
Do you, and we need to go to break, but I want to follow up on that immediately. Yeah. I guess you are hopeful that we will once again learn hard lessons and
yes.
Through this kind of stress test that many think we're going through in our democracy, and we'll come out stronger.
To give you one more analogy on it, this is like Uncle Sam is in the ring and he's fighting an opponent that a lot of people seem to think are going to beat him. And I want to remind the reader, this is an opponent Uncle Sam has fought and won every single time. Now, he's been bloodied, he's been bruised, they haven't been clean wins, but he's never lost once to this opponent, this many, many times faced opponent. So yeah, we have every reason to expect he'll win today, but that's all the more reason to fight harder, not to phone it in, because it's not a guarantee either. But the skill set is there, the ability is there, so step up and do it.
Let's take a break. We'll come back with much more with Greg Jackson. He is the author of the recently released book. It's out and available now. Been There, Done That, How Our History Shows What We Can Overcome. He's host of the podcast History That Doesn't Suck, one of the most popular history podcasts out there. And he's America 250 professor in constitutional studies at Utah Valley University. We'll talk more following this break. Thank you for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're pleased to have with us Greg Jackson, who is America 250 professor in constitutional studies at Utah Valley University, author of the book, the recent book, new book, Been There, Done That, How Our History Shows What We Can Overcome. He's also host of the podcast, the popular podcast History That Doesn't Suck. And we have him for the hour today. Very pleased with that. So Greg Jackson, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about another echo from the past, what you call in this book, which you describe, I think, accurately as the thoroughly corrupt presidential election of 1876. This is, you know, and we have accusations being hurled by the president and others of unfounded accusations of corrupt elections here. But I guess you're telling us that here's a parallel here. We have survived absolutely corrupt elections.
Yes, we have. Of course, there's other elections that I give examples of in the book as well that highlight different aspects of that very much rhyme with our present. But in this episode in particular, this is unequivocally the most corrupt presidential election that we've had, 1876. The sordid tale began on the night, or rather, the let me say the sordid tale began to reveal itself on the night of November 7th, 1876, when a Union general, now turned politico, Dan Sickles, very fascinating character, this Union general made his way into Republican headquarters. He himself a Democrat, but he's a Union man. And so he's supporting Rutherford Hayes, a former Union general and the Republican candidate, over his own party's candidate, Democrat Sam Tilden. Dan shows up at headquarters and finds the place deserted. Everyone's given up hope. Sam Tilden is leading the popular vote with about 250,000. Now, of course, any good constitution lover out there knows that the popular vote is an indicator, but not where the scoreboard is. It's all about those electoral votes. Nonetheless, the expectation is that that Sam Tilden has this sewn up. He has 184 electoral votes. 185 is the required number to win. He just needs one more, and there are still other states yet to report. He's got such a lead in the popular vote. It's done for, and this is a different era. A lot of these Republican officials have checked out. They are very, very drunk on whiskey and just trying to drown their sorrows. But in all of this, Dan sits down. He looks at the states that haven't reported. And he concludes that if the three southern states of South Carolina, Florida, Louisiana, and if Oregon, if those states all come in for Hayes, and it's possible, well, the Republican just might pull this off after all. He'll pick up the necessary votes. He'll get to 185. He'll close that 20 electoral vote gap. He pushes around, musters with those that are still present. There's a clerk. He wants to telegram leaders in those states to say, don't concede. He finally gets permission. He tells them to hold their state. Now, what exactly does hold mean? Does that mean to simply not concede? Does that mean to hold regardless of what the numbers look like? I'll leave that to anyone who reads the book or who's listening now to contemplate. But the long story short is that the next morning, in this centennial year of the United States, newspapers across the nation proclaim Sam Tilden the winner, except for the conservative at this time, New York Times. It's the lone standout major paper that says, no, not yet determined. Okay. This is what I mean by November 7th, 1876, being the moment that starts to pull the thread. And now we realize just how corrupt this election has already been and how corrupt it's going to yet become. The contest to get these states' votes jumps into overdrive. There is a train with returns that gets, and I'm quoting sources here, Ku Kluxed. So paramilitary. Now, let's pause and think about that. The Democratic Party and, Democratic, Republican, we're in the 19th century. There's so much time between. I prefer to tell my students, just realize they're different parties altogether, pretty much. The Democratic Party at this point is very much filled with ex-Confederates. And they Ku Klux, which is to say they intercede with a train that's carrying electoral votes to stop them. As things play out, we have party leaders that descend upon each of these states to go and watch the electoral, to watch the returns come in, the votes, that is, that will inform what the electoral votes for each state actually are. Things that get exposed in the process. First of all the election boards, so the individuals in each state who are supposed to oversee how the vote went, pretty much all of them proved to be extremely corrupt. Meanwhile, South Carolina, I'm not a math guy, Tom, but I'm pretty sure there's a problem if a state casts 101% of its vote. That's what they do.
Yeah.
Yeah, right? So over 100% of the registered vote of those who are eligible to vote in the state cast a ballot. We know that there were participants from Georgia. We know of one gentleman who cast over 70 votes. So this guy voted more times in this one election than some of us are going to vote legally our entire lives. And there's manipulation. There's to cut through so many pieces here. both parties claim victory. So it's not just a question of, oh, are these acceptable electoral votes? Candidly, 2020 is easy compared to this. Congress has to deal with South Carolina sending two sets of electoral votes. The Republicans claiming that they have the votes. The Democrats also claiming that they have the votes. Also, each of those two parties set up their own state government, not only claiming that they won the presidency, but claiming that they won various state legislative seats, the governorship, and so forth. So we now have two rival governments set up, each sending their own set of electoral votes to Congress, as we know that there is evident voter fraud. Let's jump down to Florida. Here we know that a Republican official showed up with over $10,000 in cash in a bag, ready to pay bribes to buy off the votes. Now, this is a lot of money today, but this is 1876. I mean, he's brought a small fortune. Later congressional investigations in the years to follow are also going to demonstrate that there were about 600 coded telegrams that required a cipher to read, sent by the Democratic Party from leaders in New York to southern states, explicitly describing and discussing which Republican officials would most likely be willing to cave with a bribe. So we know that happened. again, both sides claim the win. In fact, we end up with three sets of electoral votes sent because the Democrats do it twice. So, yeah, of course, leave it to Florida to send the most complicated electoral vote count humanly possible. Some things truly do never change. Louisiana, here are where the stories of violence get the worst. Now, let me be clear. They're not isolated on this. We know of at least, this is a conservative estimate from a historian who was basically an apologist for the Confederacy. About 150 Black Americans were killed in South Carolina in the lead up to the vote. Let's just pause and absorb that for a second. I'm talking about one state. Violence intended to keep Black Americans away from the polls ended the lives of approximately on a low side 150 Black Americans. That's to say nothing of the violence that chased off, the violence that was survived, the violence that kept people from showing up to the polls. And this behavior, often known as the Mississippi Plan, played out across all the southern states. That's just a number from South Carolina. But now as we jump to Florida, you know, the depositions, the stories, as the board was meeting and trying to decide what to do, Eliza Pinkston told a horrific tale that I will, for the sake of your listeners, not go into the same detail that I do in the book. And look, Tom, I believe that it is my duty as a historian to allow the truth to just be there. You know, I'm not here to, I would not be doing my job as a historian if I make hard truths easier. But Eliza tells the board in a room filled with Republican and Democratic national leaders about this night, just a few nights before the election, in which effectively Ku Klux Klan types, this is Louisiana, so most likely be the White League, but the title of their organization is truly not necessary or as important as what they do. They tell her husband that he will never, very swear laden and racist language, he will never cast a Republican vote again. They castrate him and they kill him. They kill her baby. And they rape and physically abuse her. She is brought in to testify, being carried on a cot because her Achilles has been slit. She can't walk. These were actions taken in the election of 1876. And again, the board is filled with corrupt figures. The Democrats refuse to accept the corrupt Republican board's decisions. And both parties claim to be the legitimate government of the state. We have two state governments, just as in South Carolina, and both send electoral votes to Congress. And then, you know, Oregon often gets forgotten in the story. But Oregon had one elector who was a post officer, a postman. Well, we all know you can't have, you know, that's in the Constitution, that you can't be a paid public servant and serve as an Electoral College voter. So the Democrats try to make a lot of hay out of this, even though Oregon has state laws on the books that already clarified what to do. It's clearly a Republican vote still. Nonetheless, the Democrats disagree. They send their own version of the count. Because remember, Sam Tilden only needs one vote, right? So they send a count in which they acknowledge two electoral votes of their three going to the Republicans, but they claim one going to them as Democrats. So we now have four states that have sent at least two, Florida being at three, sets of Electoral College returns with ample evidence of bribes, attempted bribes, corruption in the boards, corruptions in, among state judges, and murder on an incredible scale, as well as other acts of violence. And Congress has to sort out who's the winner in this election. Now, to fast forward a little bit, they come up with a commission, and Joseph Bradley becomes the closest thing to a swing vote. But incredibly, the Republicans mop it up. They bat 1,000, and they manage to, the commission with Joseph Bradley as that, a Supreme Court judge, to be clear, with seven staunch Republicans, seven staunch Democrats, Joseph Bradley, kind of a mild Republican, the Republicans win it. And all sorts of games are being played. There are cries of Tilden or blood among Democrats who say they're ready to have a second civil war if he doesn't win. And Jeremiah Black, he's a Democratic lawyer. He gives his closing argument at the end of this commission's, you know, decision making. And he rails. Honestly, some of his points are pretty valid. He decries the Republicans who, amid backroom deals, have been conceding that if the Democrats will accept Rutherford Hayes as the winner, that the Republicans can let the enforcement of Reconstruction, which is to say federal troops in the South trying to protect Black Americans and the new rights that that they deserve in order to make our American Republic truly live up to its promises that all men are created equal. The Republicans have basically agreed that they're gonna just stop enforcing that. They'll pull back federal troops if the Democrats accept this win for the Republicans. And Jeremiah Black rails that we will never have such a thing as an honest election again. It's dead. Basically, this is the end of the Republic. We've ended it. And, you know, from there in the book, I jump us forward. You know, we then do talk about the election of 2020 in the from the prism of what the election of 1876 means. And one thing I'd love, you know, I ask my readers to, you know, to contemplate, and I'll put forth to your listeners now, is that Jeremiah Black was convinced, right? He's in the thick of it. He's in the worst of it. He's looking at all the things the Republicans are willing to overlook in this moment. He's looking at, I don't know that he's looking at what his party has done, his party's egregious, dishonest, absolute betrayal of the name of their own party. There's nothing Democratic about what the Democrats are up to. Just as the Republicans are ready to betray the highest of values and American ideals. And he's looking at this and saying the Republic's dead. And yet, Tom, it is the 20th century that Americans of all stripes today, you know, with some variation perhaps, but we look to the 20th century when we talk about America's golden age as, you know, achieving its status as American superpower, as being the example to the world of democracy. So our best days were actually still ahead of us at this low moment in 1876, which is where I ask listeners and readers today to pause and contemplate, why can't our best days still be ahead of us now? And the answer to that is that they can be, but it's up to us.
Mm-hmm. Let's take another break. We'll come back much more to discuss in our final segment with Greg Jackson. He is America 250 professor in constitutional studies at Utah Valley University. He's host of the podcast History That Doesn't Suck and author of the book Been There, Done That, How Our History Shows What We Can Overcome. We'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams, and we're talking with Greg Jackson, who is author of the new book, Been There, Done That, How Our History Shows What We Can Overcome. He's host of the popular podcast, History That Doesn't Suck, and is America 250 professor in constitutional studies at Utah Valley University. I wanted to kind of briefly wrap up this conversation, then have you talk a little bit about your podcast, and you have a stage presentation as well that you give.
Sure.
So before the break, you were talking about this contested election of 1876, given some of the horrific things that you shared with us there. Contested.
I'm sorry, Tom, was that too much?
No, it's good for us to look at this, right, and not shy away.
That's the point. Yes, that's absolutely the point.
So I was saying the contested seems like a small word there. but then we did, you know, we did have a, you know, long string of what we think, you know, clean elections. The consequences of that were very, very bad, right? That compromise of 1877, federal troops removed, Jim Crow was then established, and another 100 years and until the 1960s of very, very bad things happening. I guess what I wanted to talk to you about was this public virtue. And that's what I think you think this hinges on, whether we'll have an optimistic future or no. And that was a competing vision from the first. Alexander Hamilton said the people is a beast, right? We need to didn't have an optimistic view of them. Thomas Jefferson had a very positive view, a very, you know, narrow set of the populace, that yeoman farmer who's going to be virtuous and close to the land and steer us right through our history. I wonder where you, having, you know, reviewed all this history for this book, where do you land on where... Are we up to, I guess what my question is, are we up to this public virtue that you say we need to do?
Yeah, thank you. That might be one of my favorite questions I've been asked in the midst of all the book touring. And yes, unequivocally, yes. The vote has expanded. You know, part of why the founding generation, and yes, let's acknowledge there's sexism, there's racism. Those are there. Their rationale, as in their limited perspective, they limited the vote as they did to those that they thought could be trusted with public virtue, which largely for them were land owners, right, and white men, and that's where we get to Jefferson's concept of the yeoman farmer. I believe that the American Republic has demonstrated, as it has continued to become a more perfect union, despite these horrific tales I'm telling you, as we have come closer to that through the expansion of the vote, as we ended slavery with the 13th Amendment, and as women were brought into the fold with the 19th Amendment, as the Civil Rights Act fulfilled the promises that were made and then largely betrayed through the 15th Amendment to Black Americans, as Native Americans in the 1920s were finally acknowledged as American citizens. You know, as we've taken all of these steps, I have seen America become a stronger and better place. Two steps forward, one step back. But we are capable of this. You know, Thomas Jefferson, he had a lot of things to say about public virtue. And I do echo a lot of his words, though I, of course, extend the trust and belief in people much, much further than he did. But he said that education, first of all, was just paramount. He wrote a letter to a friend of his, and, you know, so we still have it, a fellow revolutionary, calling for public education. And in it, he said that the cost, the tax that we will pay to ensure our citizens are, I'm paraphrasing, but the tax that we'll pay to ensure our fellow citizens are educated and can thus participate in this republic is a fraction of what we will pay to kings and priests, without having this, without having that service there. And another thing that he said that I really want Americans to keep in mind as we think about today's challenges with misinformation. Jefferson, who himself, you know, we started this conversation talking about his role in a partisan print war, and indeed propping up. You touched on that, and I didn't even bite the apple. Yeah, he used government funds to prop up Philip Freneau as he wrote an opposition paper that attacked the Washington administration. It'd be insane to see that happen today. So Jefferson knows what it is to see partisan print. He's encouraged partisan print. And he himself once said that a man would be better informed by not reading a newspaper than reading one. But this same Jefferson, when we, you know, complicated figure, says different things at different times. And that's not necessarily even a contradiction. But this same Jefferson made a comment that we have, as of yet, found it better to trust the people, not a magistrate, with the discernment between truth and falsehoods. And I stand by that, Tom. Mm. We would kill, we would gut the First Amendment. And I don't just say that because, you know, it's the First Amendment, because it's in the Constitution, but, you know, the true principle behind it. American liberty, as we conceive of it, dies without the ability for people to express themselves, without the press to be able to write. And that does, unfortunately, lower guardrails against misinformation, right? Fake news. And, you know, we can't cover my whole book here in this one conversation, but I regale the readers with stories of that as well. Intentional misinformation from the revolutionary era right on up to yellow journalism. Yeah, Americans have been led astray at times. Americans have cast votes that we regret, decisions. Dred Scott, I mean, even our most, you know, elite figures within our republic, the Dred Scott decision, 1857, terrible, right? Plessy v. Ferguson, terrible. We get things wrong, but I do believe that we have the public virtue to get enough of it right and to correct when we've gotten it wrong, even if it is a long arc. I'm sorry. I guess that's a long way to say yes.
No.
I believe.
Oh, yeah, no, that's great. That's great. And I'm warmed by your optimism. I'm going to try to share it. So just about a minute left. Tell us a bit about a very small bit about your podcast, History That Doesn't Suck. What are you trying to do with the podcast?
Yeah, it's been running for almost a decade, and I started that wanting to increase historical literacy. The point was to tell stories that draw the listener in so that you'll learn your history and civics. You know, history sucks when it's names and dates, but it doesn't when you get to know the people and you realize that they had the same fears and trepidations that we do today. They don't know that, you know, that their fears in the revolution, George Washington doesn't know that he's going to win the revolution. He knows that his army's collapsing all around him in December of 1776. And Thomas Paine is writing, "These are the times that try men's souls." Right. So getting into that space where we can relate, that's what makes history come to life. So I've used storytelling, and that's been, you know, that's led millions of Americans to tune in and learn their history.
You can find that wherever you find your podcasts, I guess, right? History Doesn't Suck. It's one of the top history podcasts out there, so congratulations on that. You can find your stage presentation these days on PBS, I think.
Yes, you can.
Film that, and it'll be coming to a town near you, I guess, in the near future. Enjoyed the discussion. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Greg Jackson is author of the new book, Been There, Done That, How Our History Shows What We Can Overcome. He's host of the podcast, History That Doesn't Suck, and he's America 250 professor in constitutional studies at Utah Valley University. You can also find that Politico magazine article that we referenced as well. Greg Jackson's been our guest. We appreciate that. And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.
This is Science by the Slice. It's not easy eating green. Most plants are heavily defended with chemicals to deter would-be grazers. Getting enough to eat while minimizing exposure to toxins is a persistent challenge that shapes herbivores' foraging choices. USU ecologist Sarah Weinstein studies dietary choices of wood rats and how they manage the risks of consuming potentially harmful foods. Weinstein says knowledge gained from the study sheds light on food webs, species interactions, and which animals are more likely to persist in changing ecosystems.
This segment of Science by the Slice is brought to you by the USU College of Arts and Sciences, offering degree programs in the sciences and mathematics. Details at artsci.usu.edu.
I'm Jay Allison, producer of the Moth Radio Hour, and I hope you'll join us for our show here on Utah Public Radio, with true personal stories told live without notes to standing room crowds around the world. Moth shows are renowned for the range of human experience they reveal. That's the Moth Radio Hour, Saturday evening at 6, right here on Utah Public Radio.
If you love discovering new music, UPR invites you to tune in to the Corner Concert Series. We present our on-air showcase for this month with performances from Antique Loft, Wyatt Goodwin, and a special radio-only performance from Sunny Day Soap Opera. Catch the Corner Concert Series on-air special this Friday at 10 a.m. and this Saturday at 3 p.m. only on Utah Public Radio.
This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSU FM Logan.